Welcome to Sports Coach Radio. Sports psychology this week with one of the country's leading practitioners. Dr. Jim Taylor has been a consultant for the United States and Japanese ski teams, the United States Tennis Association, and USA Triathlon. He's also worked with world-class athletes in cycling, track and field, swimming, football, golf, and baseball. He's been invited to lecture by the Olympic committees of Spain, France, Poland, and the United States, and has consulted with the athletic departments at Stanford University and the University of California, Berkeley. There's tons of great information on his website, drjimtaylor.com. And from there, you can get links to the excellent articles he writes for the Huffington Post and Psychology Today. Sports Coach Radio is a weekly series of interviews with world-leading coaches, sports scientists, and sports writers. It's hosted by me, Glenn Whitney. I'm a mentor to coaches and a leadership advisor. You can follow us on Twitter, where we post coaching news and tips just about every day of the week. The handle is @SportsCoachTalk. Please help make the show increasingly popular by writing a short review, just a sentence or two on the Apple iTunes page. Many thanks to Dana Rogers for a recent review. Dr. Jim Taylor, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Glenn.
Let's start with this idea you have that sports psychology has a kind of second-class status, among the disciplines of getting creating elite athletes. What's that about?
Well, there are some key aspects of reaching elite status in sports. Obviously, physical conditioning, technique, tactics, nutrition, and so on. And these are held in very high regard based upon the fact that pretty much every professional team, every Olympic team, every major university has full-time conditioning people, nutritionists, obviously technical coaches as well. And yet sports psychology, everybody will say it's as or more important than the physical and technical side of sport. And yet there's not great evidence that people actually believe that or buy into it. You know, more often than not, sports psychologists or mental trainers are brought in when there's a problem. And though that is changing a bit, more and more universities and national teams and pro teams are taking on sports psychologists. They're not full-time positions, and they're not held with the same sense of it matters as some of the other areas of athletic performance.
So it's really only a handful of teams who are deploying sports psychologists in that kind of systematic way that they're deploying strength and conditioning specialists. Is that right? Can you describe the kind of typical mandates of a sports psychologist?
Well, there are a growing number of, but still relatively small number of Division I university teams, athletic departments, that have full-time sports psychologists. And their mandate is to teach the athletes, to get the athletes' minds into good shape, just like the conditioning coaches get their bodies into shape. And the reality is as I think Yogi Berra said famously, 90% of sports, the other half is in your head. And again, you ask 99 out of 100 coaches or athletes how important the mental side is, and they'll say it's as or more important. And so it's clearly so important, and yet I think the challenge is that it's not tangible. It's difficult to measure the mental side effectively, whereas you want to see how strong somebody is. You have them do a bunch of squats. You see how fast they are. You have them run a 40. But the mental side, it's really hard for people to wrap their arms around. I think also psychology, sports psychology still carries the burden of being psychology, in that when people think of psychology, they think of mental illness and being on a couch and psychoanalysis. And that's just not what we do. And we help athletes clear the path and teach them the skills so they can perform at their highest level in the most challenging conditions, which is a World Series, an Olympics, and so on.
And as you look across your profession, do you see examples in other countries where maybe they're doing it more in a more systematic way?
Well, Canada has always been pretty darn open to sports psychology at their Olympic level and among the NHL teams up there. Australia is pretty cutting edge as well. Scandinavian countries, England. But that's partially, I would guess, a function of the size of the organization and the size of the countries. That's just easier to organizationally mandate or direct an increased role of sports psychology within their sports.
Now, I'll see if I can make a complicated point. But it feels to me in the U.S. there's a lot of specialization from sport to sport. So, you know, coaches, even S&C coaches, but particularly coaches themselves, they really don't move from basketball to baseball or baseball to football, very rarely. Whereas you see a lot more of that in the U.K., where I'm familiar with. They expect the sports psychologist to be similarly specialized, where a sports psychologist is just doing basketball or just doing football?
There are some people like that around the country. I'm not sure there's that expectation. I think that it certainly helps to have expertise in a sport. I competed internationally as an alpine ski racer, and I work a great deal with ski racers now. And I think it brings me my experience as an athlete, I think really helps me because, A, I know what it's like to be plummeting down a mountain at 70 miles an hour. I know what it's like to be in the starting gate of an international competition. Also, I know all the different aspects of the sport, the technical, the physical, the tactical, and so on. Also, from a practical perspective, I can get out on the hill and work with skiers while they're actually skiing. So I can ski with them, and that's where I do a lot of my best work, is in the actual training or competitive environment. There's nothing worse than, an example, I was in the very bottom of the U.S. ski team many years ago, and a sports psychologist came to talk. And he started talking about ski sticks. And we're thinking, ski sticks? Does he mean ski poles? and at the very
That's
least,
yeah.
It's important to talk the language. Mm-hmm. So I do think that specialization helps. But there's no doubt that there are some very competent and capable and successful sports psychologists who haven't worked in a particular sport. You have to study it, you have to understand it, but you have to have direct experience like a basketball coach or so on. Probably not.
And you're right that certainly the vast majority of thinkers I've read and experts consulted and in an interview situation. And almost everyone agrees that it's at least 50%, the psychological side, the emotional side, the mental side. But it's a tiny fraction of the amount of time invested in the various physical aspects and technical aspects of the sport. How much time would you say would be useful? I know it's hard to generalize, but if you could kind of describe an optimal sports psychology program, what would it look like?
Well, that's the great thing about sports psychology. A lot of it is actually built into the normal things that athletes do. I spend time in the gym. Let's say athletes are doing strength workouts. A great place to start to develop mental skills is in the gym. So, for example, they have to do a set of squats. Well, that is a physical performance with a start, a performance, and a finish. Not unlike the start, the finish of a ski race or a tennis match or what have you. And so there's a great place where it can be built in. Also, on the court, on the course, on the hill, on the field, it's possible. It's very possible and very practical to teach these mental skills while they're actually practicing. Imagine, for example, Glenn, a technical coach, let's say a soccer coach, having to sit in an office with a group of athletes, a group of soccer players, and say, "This is what I want you guys to do run these plays, and work on these technical things in your game." Now you just go out there and do it. And the athletes get out there on the field, and the soccer players are going like, "Well, I don't know." The power of being a coach is they're on the field, in the moment, being able to intervene and work the kids directly, the athletes directly. And that's where there's tremendous value for the things that we do as well. So teaching mental skills related to motivation, confidence, intensity, focus, emotions, all these things can be best taught in the situation, in the practice situation. So a lot of it can be done, built right into typical training or practice scenarios. Off the field, court, course, and hill, it only takes probably 15, 20 minutes a day, perhaps some imagery. No doubt, imagery for me is the most powerful mental tool where athletes see and feel themselves performing the way they want. 15 minutes a day there. I do a lot of work with athletes in team situations where, for example, we'll pick a topic, a team talk, and it might have to do with different things related to fear of failure or expectations or how to deal with pressure or whatever it is. And we'll have what I call team talks, where we sit around and just talk about a topic. And the value of this is some education, some sense of, oh, yeah, we all feel this way, because what typically when athletes are struggling mentally, they think they're the only ones who have ever struggled this way, when these are very common issues. So the fact is, developing a pretty comprehensive sports psych program isn't incredibly time-consuming. Let's be realistic, athletes from high school kids up to pros, they have very busy lives, and there's just not a lot of room for it. And yet what I suggest is that they have to make room for it, because at the highest level, it's not about conditioning or technique or tactics. Think about the World Championships, ski championships are going on in Vail just up the road from you, Glenn. And if you think about, let's say, the top 15 in all the different events, first of all, they're all genetic freaks. They're all incredibly gifted, talented athletes. Second, they're in the best possible physical condition. They've got the best equipment. They've got the best technique and tactics. So on any given day, what separates the gold medalist, bronzed, down to 15 or 20? It's what goes on in their head. And so because that is so important, it still shocks me, and I am biased given what I do for a living, that it hasn't become better, more woven into the fabric of athletes' lives.
Yeah, I agree. It is very surprising and even, you know, a bit disappointing. But there's a lot of upside potential, obviously. And what you're saying makes a lot of sense about being in there in the fitness workouts and in the strength and conditioning sessions, but doesn't that necessitate that you have to work alongside another coach? And how does that work out?
Yeah, it can be problematic. It can be phenomenal. The best work I ever do is with a coach who's open to my stuff, who's not threatened by my presence, and whose only goal is let's help these athletes become more successful. The problem is that coaching can be territorial. And believe it or not, Glenn, there are egos involved in coaching. And so someone like myself can be perceived as a threat. And it's really important when I go to work with an athlete or a team that the coaches have buy-in and understand that we're all here for the same thing, to help the athletes and the coaches and the team become successful as possible. And when there can be collaboration in the work I do with the work the coaches do, then the athletes win, the teams win. Because also, I'm a big believer that really good coaches are great intuitive psychologists. They might not have the degree or the coursework, but so much of what they do is psychological. And so for me to be able to collaborate with them and communicate and problem solve and make decisions about how best to structure what is needed for the athletes, it's a powerful and wonderful experience.
So when you're giving these team talks or when that's being set up, how best is it, you know, what's the optimal way to describe you? How do you like the head coach to introduce you into the equation?
Oh, I don't really care. It becomes clear, you know, what I'm doing there. You call me a sports psychologist, a mental trainer, a mental coach. I don't care. I'm there to help them become mentally prepared. And the reality is that serious athletes, in general, understand that the mind is important, as I've said a couple times before, but they just don't know what exactly that involves. It's not just a matter of in the conditioning side, lifting weights or how fast you can run. It's just this sort of ethereal stuff going on in your head. And so my job is to show them that this is not psychoanalysis. No offense to psychoanalysis. It's a wonderful tool. And it's not shrinking people. It's about giving these athletes the tools, the mental tools, just like they get the physical and technical tools that will help them perform their best when it matters most.
I mean, I guess the ironic thing is that if you think about something like a back squat for a swimmer or a rower or somebody like that, it's not necessarily definitively proven that that's a good thing to do to prepare you to be a faster swimmer or a faster rower. Yet, I would imagine you get more resistance to carving out, particularly if it is extra time, the 20, 30 minutes on mental training, then you would get resistance from some of these athletes to spending time back squatting.
Without a doubt. And it goes back. One reason is that it is not as tangible and clear cut. The benefits aren't as obvious. You can't just see a gain in confidence the way you can see a gain in strength or speed. But I think that part of it is that it's the culture we live in, the athletic culture we live in, is still evolving. It's still becoming more sophisticated. I would like to think that in, you know, 30, 40 years, I'm probably going to be dead by then. Sports psychology will just be part of the system, and every team will have a sports psychologist or a mental coach on their payroll. But I think there are some, I wrote a blog post not long ago titled something like The Five Reasons Why Athletes Don't Do Mental Training. And one of them is that it's not fully supported by their coaches and by the team. Another is that it's not tangible. They can't see it. And another, I think this is probably one of the biggest ones, is it's just not a part of what they do. It's not a part of their program. So they'll think it's really important and want to do it, but they just forget because it's not built into their routine. And so a big part of what I do is simply constantly reminding them that you have to do this. You have to do this. This is important to you. And build, put it in your phone, your calendar in your phone, so you get notifications. Because generally, if I'm working with them, they believe this stuff has some value, but they need to be fully convinced. And one of the most important things I do, and this is especially the case when I'm working with them in a training or practice situation, or even more in a competitive situation, is if they do this, let's say imagery, or relax more, or get fired up more, or focus more, they perform better. When they don't do it, they perform worse. If I can get them to see that connection, then they're going to go, my gosh, for me to achieve my athletic goals, I need to do this stuff. And even better, those other guys, the other team, the other athletes aren't doing that stuff. So if I do this stuff, I'm at a real advantage here. And that way, I have a better chance of beating them. Because athletes are very instrumental. They're very goal-driven. If you can give them something that will help them achieve their goals, and you can demonstrate that that's the case, they're pretty likely to do it if they're committed athletes.
Yeah, that's entirely sensible. This idea that it can be a competitive advantage. In fact, it is likely to be a competitive advantage, right? We could confidently assert that all things being equal, athlete A with the same sort of physiology and skills and experience as athlete B, and athlete B has done the mental training, what kind of advantage do you think is possible?
Well, this is an interesting thing. When I give a talk to athletes, at the end I say, what do I need to do to convince you to do this stuff? How do I get you to buy in? And I'll say, give me a percentage that I have to guarantee that you will improve for you to buy into this stuff. And so they don't even think about it. So they throw out 20%. Well, let's use the example of ski racing because it's easily quantifiable. 90 seconds, two runs of giant slalom. 20% is 18 seconds. Glenn, I'm pretty good at what I do, but I can't make a ski racer go 18 seconds faster in a 90-second course. But because those kind of margins are just absurdly high. But how about if I say, I'll bet I can get you to go 0.5% faster. Now, that sounds like an incredibly small amount, Glenn, doesn't it? And yet, that's 4.5 tenths of a second. In a ski race, that is night and day. And you can find those kind of number differences in just about every sport. In golf, if you can hit two more fairways in a tournament, a four-round tournament, that is exponential difference in the difference between first and 25th. And so at the highest level, the margins of improvement and the margins of victory are so small that I don't have to promise many, many percent of improvement. Because, again, nobody can – at that level, it's all about the very, very minute differences that make the difference between victory, 5th, 10th, 50th. And so if I can demonstrate that to athletes, and I think I generally do, then they're going to go, boy, yeah, 4 tenths of a second? I really want those 4 tenths of a second because that is the difference between – winning a World Cup and maybe making a World Cup or qualifying for the ski team or whatever it might be.
Well, the sense I get is that there's resistance because mental training, particularly the kind of focus that you sometimes require, is painful. So, you can call it brain pain. And athletes, they do have, obviously, most of them, a tremendous capacity for hard work and pain tolerance. But when it comes to brain pain, it doesn't really matter if we say that they have less tolerance than the normal population or just the same. Most people, and if we think back to our undergraduate psychology days, they're cognitive misers. They just want to minimize the amount of time they spend thinking about stuff because it's expensive to heat up all that gray matter.
Yeah, it is. And there are different aspects of that. Part of it is that people are afraid of what they might find. You know, again, this goes to sort of the deeper psychology stuff that I might find out they're crazy or something. Even though I don't practice clinical psychology, I don't deal with mental illness, anything like that. It's such an unknown that they're afraid to go there very often. And the fact is, with a lot of my work, it's not deep psychological stuff, but it's exploring. As an example, a lot of the athletes I work with have a profound fear of failure. And that requires some digging, some really understanding, a real understanding of where is this fear coming from? Is it that my parents won't love me? People will perceive me as a total failure if I fail? And so they're afraid of what they might find. And also, the mental stuff, it's just not part of the way they look at pursuing elite sports. This is, like you talk about, there's brain pain, and then there's muscle pain. Athletes are very familiar and very comfortable with muscle pain because it means they're doing things. But brain pain, that's a different kind of experience that they're not usually that familiar with, and that very often they're afraid of. And what I try to do is I want them to embrace, as you call it, brain pain. Because just like the physical pain, if athletes are not feeling any physical pain, they're not getting stronger, they're not improving. And the same holds true for brain pain. If they're not feeling uncomfortable, if I'm not making my athletes uncomfortable, then they are not pushing themselves, they're not challenging themselves, they're not moving out of their comfort zone. In other words, they're staying right where they are. And the worst thing in the world for an athlete is to have to think that they're not getting any better.
And as you alluded before, this idea that you bring in somebody and he's going to shrink your head doesn't sound very pleasant. It sounds a bit scary. But you'd think it would be obvious that we've brought Dr. Jim in, and he's a sports psychologist, and the reason we brought him in is to make you go faster or hit harder or whatever it is. But how specific and obvious do you need to clarify what your role is? In other words, not to diagnose whether they're insane or not, but actually help them achieve their goals.
Right. Well, that's where it's very important. The first session that I meet with, let's say, a team or even an individual athlete is tell them what I do. Because people, I'm brought in by often parents or a team to work with an athlete or group of athletes because there's some sort of, quote, problem or they're not living up to their ability. But they don't exactly know what I do. Because young athletes aren't educated about what is involved in sports psychology and mental preparation. So what I have to go in and I have this model that I use that I've developed that presents some of the key areas that I think are most influential for enhancing sports performance. And I talk about skills. I talk about drills. I talk about tools. So things that are very tangible. Because athletes are doers. They want to be able to do things to get better. They want to lift weights. They want to run laps, whatever it might be. So I want them to understand that I'm training their mind in very much the same way that they are training their body. And that it takes consistency. It takes a structured program. It takes commitment. It takes patience. Another little side note on that, Glenn, is that I get calls a week before the Nationals or the Junior Nationals in some sport, saying, you got to help my kid. would parents or team ever go to a conditioning coach and say, you've got a week to get my kid into shape? No.
Yeah, we've got a crisis here. Can you do some emergency bench press sets?
Right. And yet somehow people think that a sports psychologist or a mental coach can come in and fix things. And on occasion, I've had those, quote, miracles happen where an athlete or a team just needed to be reoriented, a little perspective, a little change in attitude. But more often than not, it's like a guarantee of failure for me because I'm pretty good at what I do, but I'm not a magician. I don't have magic dust. It has to be approached the same way as physical side of sport.
Yeah, that reminds me of one coach said, you know, when you talk about sports psychologists, you know, you need to remind people that you're not a mind reader. You're a psychologist. It's not a separate, you know, separate discipline, mind reading. And, you know, it's a kind of a carnival function that gypsies or some people like that are supposed to have. But anyway, but, you know, back to this issue. I mean, we're kind of skirting around this idea of, you know, how do you optimize performance in very, very ambitious athletes? And I wonder if there's a sense that, well, what, you know, psychologists come in and maybe their job is to make people happy and balanced. And let's face it, I mean, you know this better than anybody, really, that to be a great athlete is not to be a normal person.
Right. I agree. The pursuit of excellence in any avenue requires a degree of imbalance. And I don't want to say craziness in the sense of, like you suggest, insanity, but you have to, it's like life with the volume turned up. And so a lot of the issues that the athletes I work with struggle with, if they were just sort of normal people in normal jobs and normal school, these wouldn't be issues. But they're putting themselves in a place where they're trying to get into the top one half of 1% of their sport. And that requires very high levels, unusually high levels of motivation, confidence, the ability to handle pressure, the ability to focus effectively, the ability to make to commit to performance. The list goes on. And that's where athletes and teams are more and more looking for any edge, and hopefully legal edge, but because at the highest level, the differences are so minute.
So in some ways, you have to come in there and reassure them that you're not trying to turn them into normal, ordinary people.
No. I'm trying to help them become extraordinary or more extraordinary than they actually are. And helping them get this idea that the way to do that is, yes, do all the normal things that athletes do, the conditioning and the technical stuff and the equipment and so on, but also they have to focus on their mind. And the reality is, though, let's be honest, athletes for decades, for as long as there have been sport, many have done incredibly well without us. That is to say, sports psychologists and mental coaches, because they figured out on their own. Or they're born with some innate ability to handle pressure, or they're raised in some sort of environment where they were able to focus on things that enable them to perform well instead of things that cause them to lose focus and lose confidence and crumble. But you think about over the years as an athlete and as a sports psychologist, I have seen over and over athletes who had all the natural physical ability to become unbelievable athletes, but for some reason, whether upbringing or genes, who knows, they just didn't have the mind in the right place. And so they needed some brain training, if you will. They needed some sports psychology. And in some cases, it didn't work. In some cases, it does. In some cases, they figure it out. But again, the level of sophistication of sport these days is so high that any advantage is crucial. And a super committed athlete is going to look for any of those kind of edges.
I mean, you'd like to think that we're close to a sort of golden age where the head coach of a Division I team, NCAA, would, you know, because there's all a limit to how much mentoring they can do of these young people, ages 20, 21, that kind of thing, where they hand them over to people like you, and that tremendous potential that they're showing can be capitalized on, so that maybe you have, you know, an additional 10 or 20% of NCAA Division I athletes who are able to get to the next level. What I guess this is a roundabout way of asking the question, how much potential is there to change the quantity of elite athletes out there if the athletes themselves were to get stuck into these programs in a more comprehensive way?
Right. Yeah, boy, that's a great question. Empirically, I don't know of any data that's explored that. But I guess I would apply that same question to physical conditioning or biomechanics and technique. In that, athletes are born with certain innate abilities, and that the more of those athletes who can be a part of a truly comprehensive program that includes all these pieces of the puzzle. It seems, at least it makes intuitive sense, that you're going to get more better athletes. And so it seems to me it would be incumbent upon these programs that you know, athletes are brought in, let's say, a Division I football team, and they're all blue chippers, a lot of blue chippers and really fine athletes. Otherwise, they wouldn't be going to USC or Texas or where have you. And yet they don't all make it. So if you can give them more and more tools that will enable them to maximize their ability, then you're going to get more athletes move into a higher level.
And how early do you think athletes should start and parents should start with athletes?
And, you know, I was just interviewed about this this morning for a newspaper, and I think mental training can begin as early as 6, 7, 8 years old, but not where I get up and lecture to them or do things like that, but where coaches start to teach kids as a part of their normal sports experience some tools to help them learn to play better, like different ways of focusing more effectively, breathing, developing little routines before they begin to compete. So I think basic mental skills can be started in, you know, under 10 years old. And then say from 10 to 13 or 14, as kids start to get more serious, then it can be done a little more programmatically within a team, where there are imagery sessions, where there are team talks, where there are where a sports psychologist might give athletes on the field or course or hill or what have you different drills they can work on. And then probably, you know, for me, 13 to 17 is the sort of critical period during which athletes have a chance to make it to a truly high level or not, assuming they've done the work, because athletes tend to drop out of sport at a serious level in that time frame because A, then they don't think they're good enough. B, they find they like girls and boys better. C, they want to study, or they find other interests. And that is, for me, the critical period during which that's where specialization is going to occur in a sport. And it's also where all the different contributors, all those pieces of the puzzle that go into athletic success need to be put into place at an individual level. So it's not just everybody does this, but what is the best program for you now to develop your skills, whether technically, physically, or mentally? So that's sort of my basic progression of where sports psychology can be incorporated in. And unfortunately, the problem is that so often I get called in to work with an athlete after it's almost too late. You know, they're 18 or 19, and yes, I can give them some tools to help, but they develop certain habits that are just so neurologically wired into them that it's hard to change. And so I'm a big believer in prevention. The best way to prevent any kind of psychological or physical or technical problems from occurring is to prevent them by giving athletes a really solid foundation of skills, mental, physical, technical, that will prevent a lot of the problems that often come up. So instead of waiting, for example, Glenn, for a kid to freak out in a big competition, one out a couple years before, start talking about how do you prepare for and how do you deal with the pressure of a big competition? So by the time they get to it a couple years down the line, or maybe they've had like mini versions of it on the way, they have some tools, they have some perspective, they have some attitudes that will help them deal with it in a positive way. So even if they don't do well in a competition, it doesn't crush them. It's just, okay, I learned from that. This is what I need to do next time. So when the big one comes up, then they're prepared, so they're much less likely to crumble under the weight of expectation and pressure.
Now, you're making me kind of fantasize about a future, kind of like East Germany in the 1970s, but from a mental point of view, right? So, I mean, because I think you're absolutely right. It's that 16, 17-year-old time frame. Could we imagine, in a positive way, though, not in that negative East German way, of creating these incredibly resilient, incredibly mentally tough athletes because they've been given so much more mental conditioning than their equivalent, you know, over in an analogous country. Can you create that kind of systematic competitive advantage by getting access to 16 and 17 year olds and training them in this way?
Yeah, absolutely. And the same way if you can get kids, young kids on a conditioning program and motor skills program that will develop them into total athletes. The earlier you get them, when they're developmentally ready, of course, the better prepared they are once they're going to move up. And, I mean, let's be realistic. Look at tennis 30 years ago. Were there, you know, were there phenomenal athletes? Yes. But were they in the kind of shape that the Nadals and the Federers and the Djokovic's are now? No way. So, and that's why the level of performance, the way they're crushing the ball now, is just miles away. It's qualitatively different than it was 30, 40 years ago. And so just like that has occurred on the physical side of the game, and there have also, in sports that require equipment, again, going up to Vail World Championships, the things that these guys and gals can do on skis now is remarkable, partially because the equipment's different. The equipment has evolved. And so for me, and again, I have a bias given what I do, but this is that last piece of the puzzle that shouldn't be put in the last piece of the puzzle. It should be put in when you're putting the whole puzzle together.
Yeah, baked into the cake, as they say. So if we imagine, you know, Dr. Jim Taylor, overlord of the mental superiority program in some, let's stick with the United States. Imagine that you get this kind of massive funding. How would that program look? Would it be 16 and 17 year olds? Would they be in residence? How much time per day would they, is there a kind of maximum effective dose that you can give them?
I appreciate you giving me such power.
It's exciting. But it comes with responsibility, Jim.
It is intoxicating, but yes, there is responsibility for sure with power. It's not a certain age. I would create a program from young developmental level up to level to national teams and Olympic teams and professionals where there is a progression. A curriculum, if you will, of skills that are built into the training process. I'd have mental coaches or sports psychologists working with every team. I would have coaches who are educated to understand these things, appreciate things, and also be able to apply a lot of this stuff within their normal training. Because a big obstacle to sports psychology are coaches who have either old school notions of it or no notions at all about it. And ultimately, coaches, for an athlete or a team of athletes to benefit from sports psychology, the coaches have to buy in because they're the ones who are going to do a lot of it. But getting back to being the grand poobah of all things sports psychology is I'd create a comprehensive program from young age up to the elite level where there is a natural progression of developing skills, attitudes, and tools through that time frame, and where it's baked in, as you culinarily refer, it's baked into the programs as just what they do. Because that's the key, and that's what I spend so much time with athletes. Once I give them the basics, once I give them the basic tools in their toolbox, it's to simply make it a part of what they do. So they don't even have to think about it. That they get to the start of a practice, and they just do their imagery. Or they identify what their focus is, or they set a goal, or they breathe, whatever it might be. So it's simply what they do. Because if it's simply what they do, then they are going to do it in the most important competition of their lives. And everything I do is aimed toward that particular goal.
And is there a sort of analog of overtraining is it even imaginable where somebody's just doing too much conditioning on the mental side?
In a way, and it's interesting because I work with a handful of athletes where I'm with them all year round, typically 3 days a month. And the maximum amount of time I find that athletes can tolerate me is about 5 days in a row because I get in their head. I'm causing them to think a lot. And you talked about cognitive misers and saving cognitive energy and so on. And doing what I do with athletes is tiring for them. Because emotions, thoughts, they're not these ethereal things. They are energy. They are physical energy. So I know that I've reached my expiration date with athletes when I start to irritate them. Because it means I'm really getting in their head. But so it wouldn't be good to have me there every day. That would not be a joyful experience. Because it would just get tiring. But I think having, just like anything else, there's periodization where you have intense periods of mental stuff, just like intense periods of physical conditioning. Then you taper, you have recoveries and so on. But I generally recommend if coaches or if teams or athletes can incorporate the basics of mental training into their normal practices or normal training situations, and then 15, 20 minutes three times a week of imagery or goal setting or team talks, that's a pretty good balance. And then just like the physical side, when people get annoyed with me, athletes get annoyed with me, or they need a break, then they take a break. So I always emphasize the model I use is it's not unlike the physical side of performance. And a lot of the same sort of guidelines and rules can be followed in how to administer them.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. I guess with the distinction that if they're physically injured, you know, that may be a good time to invest more energy into mental conditioning.
Well, actually, I've written two books on the psychology of injury and rehabilitation, and it's a huge part, and it's a phenomenal time. It's not only a phenomenal time, it's an essential time to really focus on the mental side, because when an athlete's injured, not only are they physically injured, but their brain, their mind becomes injured. They lose confidence, they can lose motivation, they have doubt and worry and anxiety about falling behind. And with the work I do with injured athletes is to help them minimize the deterioration and still keep their mind in the game, keep their mind sharp. Because these days, what's fascinating is that the surgical and rehabilitative technology is so sophisticated that athletes can come back from major surgery, ACLs, shoulders, and so on, that they couldn't have 25 years ago. But just because they recover physically doesn't necessarily mean they return completely to the high performance level. Because too often the mind and the damage that is done from an injury psychologically is not also quote-unquote rehabilitated. So injury can be a wonderful time to become a better athlete. But for most athletes who are injured, they go, oh man, I'm just falling behind. This is terrible.
Mm. Yeah, and then the despair sets in. What's your take on mindfulness? You know, sometimes for some people it's just a label for certain kinds of activities. How do you view that? Is it something that is it a word you use? If not, why not? Talk about that.
Yeah, good question. Mindfulness has become sort of a catchphrase for all sorts of meditations and being present and focused and things like that. I don't talk about mindfulness. It's too non-instrumental, non-goal-directed, which is the nature of mindfulness, being in the present, focusing on the now. I'm not worrying about other things, not striving, just being here. I think philosophically and sort of practically, mindfulness is a nice thing, but I don't think a lot of athletes can resonate with it. You know, when athletes are say we're going to do yoga today, the typical reaction is, "Oh, come on!" Now, that's not to say yoga can't have some benefits, but I think the idea of mindfulness is too far outside the normal lexicon, the normal range of experience of most athletes. And it goes back to this idea, they want stuff to do. They want to pick specific areas and strengthen them. Now, for sure, there are techniques within mindfulness that apply in terms of meals, again, being present and being focused and being calm. At the same time, that's not always what you need. I work with a lot of athletes where they need to be more aggressive, and not in the I'm going to hurt you sort of way, but in the I'm going to attack this course or I'm going to give my fullest effort and not hold back sort of way. And so, and also some athletes don't need to be easy to be super relaxed and calm. They need to have incredibly high intensity, adrenaline flowing, just blood pumping. And so the idea of mindfulness has a place in the whole athletic preparation, mental side experience, but it has to be used judiciously, and it has to be introduced in a way that's not going to come across as we're not just going to sit around and meditate all day.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Let's dip our toes cautiously into Tiger Woods and Lindsey Vonn, because they are such high-profile athletes, achieved tremendous amounts of success in their sports. Now with injury problems, what's a sports psychologist? How does a sports psychologist understand the challenges that they faced in the last couple of years and that they currently face? How could a sports psychologist help in this situation?
Right. First of all, I don't know Tiger Woods from Adam, just from, you know, all the stuff you read about him constantly. Lindsay, I knew when she, very early in her career, but I've never worked with her. But in terms of Lindsay, you know, she came back this year after basically missing 2 years, two serious knee injuries. And I was shocked and amazed that she has come back so strong. So she's won a couple of World Cups already. She won a medal in the Super G. And so she's a tough gal. And she's had a lot of ups and downs, but she is incredibly determined. And you forget about it, behind all the glamour and the hanging out with Tiger Woods, that she is a phenomenally dedicated, hardworking athlete. And so it's just been really impressive that she's come back so quickly from her injuries and her rehabilitation to ski incredibly well. Now, she hasn't had the greatest World Championships up in Vail, but again, the World Championships are not really a great measure of how successful an athlete, a ski racer is, because it's just a one-off event. And that's why you often see racers who win Olympic gold medals or World Championship medals in skiing not be dominant racers on the World Cup. They just have, everything comes together, and they have it happen. So Lindsay, you know, whatever she's doing it right. As far as Tiger, you know, I think the weight of expectation, I think the certain distractions that occurred in his life a few years ago, plus the injuries, he has set the bar so high that anything less than a victory is a failure, and that's really unfortunate. Because he is still a phenomenal athlete. He still loves the game, obviously. He still has his victories. But being able to win a major on the PGA Tour is statistically incredibly small. And the fact that he's won, I think, 14 of them at this point, I forget exactly, is remarkable. And, you know, he's getting older now. Game may decline. Plus, he's had all these injuries. Plus, he's had all these personal challenges. It's amazing that he's been able to keep it going as long as he has and as well as he has, despite not having won a major in a while. So, you know, what would I do with him? I don't know at this point because I don't know what his issues are or if he even has any. But the fact that they found each other, it's not uncommon. It's like two actors who meet and fall in love and have kids because, you think about it. Tiger Woods doesn't meet many regular people. Neither does Lindsay. They understand the world they're in, and so they can relate to each other. And so, you know, if they're happy, more power to them. Whether they go on and have great athletic success, I'm not sure if it's really a function of their relationship.
It would make a great reality TV show, though, especially if you could have the sports psychologist sessions involved as well.
Yeah, it'd be like those nanny 911 kind of shows behind closed doors. Because it's a funny thing about one of the most interesting things about my work is that I'm able to actually go behind closed doors with the athletes I work with. I sometimes stay in their houses. You know, we're on planes together. We're at hotels. We're having dinner. So we can from the outside, we can look at these athletes' lives and think they're so wonderful to do this and that. Just like any family, you know, we don't know what goes on inside the house. So they seem like this so wonderful family. But you don't know what goes on behind closed doors in relationships. And you also don't know what goes on in the hearts and minds of these athletes. Just like we don't know anybody what's going on unless we really know them. So, you know, ultimately what I found is that these kind of freakish elite athletes, and I say freakish in terms of just genetically, amazingly what they can do, is that they're human beings. And they struggle, they have sadness, they have pain, they have excitement. It's just like maybe their volume has turned up a little more, but they're exceptional in so many ways, but they're still human beings, Glenn, and people forget that. And in a way, that's what we like to think of these athletes as superhuman, as special. But aside from the fact that they have some good genes and they've been doing it a lot more and a lot longer than the rest of us, they're just like us. Because I've known many, many world-class and professional athletes over the years, and they are remarkably human. And in a way, that's, I think, one of the wonderful things about it, because they struggle with the same things we do, just in maybe a more rarefied environment.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And sometimes I'm struck by the fact that, you know, they have the normal amount of craziness that, that everyone has or that you see across society. But when they're giving interviews, particularly TV interviews, they manage to keep it together so much so that they do seem superhuman. You know, with the rare exception of somebody like Marshawn Lynch from the Seattle Seahawks, who really seems to be, you know, struggling a bit with normal social interactions, you know, they seem super solid most of the time when they're talking to the media.
Yeah, and, you know, they have to. And I actually love it when what was it, a couple of years ago when Federer got beaten by Nadal and he was in tears after mm-hmm. the match. That's, for me, is such a wonderfully poignant and humanizing experience because we know what it's like, whether it's failing a test or losing in our own little tournament or whatever that we're in, if we're a tennis player. It brings these people closer, and I think that we like seeing people being human. And as much as we at some level think there are these like freaks or aliens, they're not. And they have the same kind of needs and goals and wants as all of us. And their lives are just under the microscope. That's a big difference.
And how is it for you to be so available or in some ways exposed? Because you're working with some of these clients, some of these athletes, you know, at 11 o'clock in the evening, over dinner, as you say, on a flight. You know, you're on duty for let's put it this way, unusual time frames compared to your clinical colleagues who, you know, are in an office for strictly, you know, 8 hours a day kind of thing.
Yeah, that's one of the truly wonderful things about what I do is that I get hit deep in life, and I can be with these athletes in all kinds of situations that are incredibly exciting and joyful, and also profoundly painful. And I'm incredibly grateful for the athletes I work with who let me into their lives and trust me enough to show their humanity, because showing that humanity goes against a lot of what they've been conditioned to believe they have to be like, meaning they have to be rocks and they have to be solid and all these things. And, I mean, it's a profoundly powerful experience to be a part of their lives and still certainly have boundaries because that enables me to have the relationship that I do with them. But still be in their lives, but be able to intervene and offer them what they need in a relatively, you know, private setting. So I'm constantly grateful and appreciative, and I think that, you know, my work has boundaries, but, you know, I'm available 24/7. I work with athletes all over the world, and if they call me up at 2 in the morning my time, I answer the phone. And am I a little tired the next day? Yes. But, A, that's the job, and you know, Mark Twain said, find something you love to do and you'll never work a day in your life, and I feel that way, and I feel very fortunate to have these experiences.
Yeah, that's great. Let's stay at this elevated level and finish off with something you've written about, which I think is really important. And I guess it relates as much as anything to younger athletes as to the, you know, the veterans who are maybe toward the end of their careers. This idea, of, probably both, of succeeding in life as well as in sport. So how can you help athletes to do that? What sort of elements need to be in place in order to maximize the potential for them to be successful in this great big, you know, life with a capital L?
Well, let me tell a quick story. I worked with an Olympic gold medalist a while back, and he decided to retire. And we sat down after the Olympics, and he said, well, and we started talking about, you know, his future and career and things like that. And he said, well, I don't have any skills, and because he didn't go to college. And I said, you have no skills, huh? So what enabled you to become an Olympic gold medalist? Well, let's see, you know, I work hard and I'm passionate about it and I'm really focused and I guess I handle pressure really well. I'm going like, wait a minute, you just listed the most important skills you need to succeed in life. And that was a real eye opener for him because he was thinking like, I need to be able to have computer skills or speaking or whatever kind of skills they are. And what I try to emphasize is that all the skills that I teach, all the attitudes, the beliefs, the perspectives that I offer, these aren't sports things. They're not sports psychology things. These are life things. And I also have done a lot of work in dance and the performing arts and in the business world and parenting. And all these things apply to all kinds of performance. And fundamentally, for me, performance is performance, whether it's athletic. I've worked with surgeons, lawyers, some military work, business people, performance is performance, and it requires many of the same sort of things. So all the tools, and for me, this is a great gift of participating in sports, is statistically speaking, the chances of a child becoming a world-class professional athlete is infinitesimal. It's like 6 in 1 million. It's not the place for parents to put their money if they're looking for an ROI, that's for sure. But what kids get out of it by committing wholeheartedly to a sport is all those other life skills. Confidence, belief in themselves, the ability to focus, ability to handle pressure, all those things, responsibility, ownership, that will serve them so well when they get to college, when they get to when they get a career, when they get married, whatever it might be. So for me, I care about my clients' athletic success as much as they do. But at a much higher order level, what I care about is, are they developing, the attitudes, beliefs, tools, skill sets that will enable them to become successful later in life? But also just as much, Glenn, is, are they going to grow up to be happy people? Because there's such an emphasis on success these days that you forget. And I've worked with a lot of really successful people in my life who were profoundly unhappy. And both personally and professionally, that ain't no way to go through life, as they say. And so part of what I teach is, yes, here are the tools to succeed, but also here are the tools to be happy. If you gave your best effort, if you did the best you could, if you enjoyed yourself, well, that's a degree of success, because very few people are going to be at the top of the podium. Very few people are going to be picking up the World Series or the Super Bowl ring. Yeah. So it's like, whatever happens at the end of their careers, can they look back and say, you know what? I made it as far as I could. I gave it everything I had. I had amazing experiences, and now I'm ready to move on. And that might be as a high school senior. It might be as a 37-year-old retiree from the NFL.
I wonder if sometimes some of these athletes are holding on too long and extending their career too far because they haven't, you know, faced that long, dark night of the soul about what they're going to do next. But it doesn't need to be that dark, does it, is the sense I get. If you could actually work with someone like you and talk through, as you say, what are my strengths, what have I learned in the process of becoming an elite athlete, and explore options, you know, they might not have to grasp on to the last, well, beyond their kind of useful life as an athlete and start transitioning over. The cleverer ones seem to do that, you know, almost naturally, that there's almost a smooth, almost non-noticeable transition from athlete to coach or athlete to business person and so forth.
Yeah, no doubt. And the research shows that Olympic and professional athletes who start planning for their retirement well in advance have a much more effective transition. And I read an article recently, something like 78% of NBA players are in financial trouble within 2 years, things like that. And same with the NFL. And so what really that ties into is identity. And for athletes who have been professional or Olympic athletes for, you know, that's who they are. Then all of a sudden, if they retire due to injury or deselection or even by choice, then it's like, who am I? And that's where problems occur. And so a big part of what I try to do with athletes at that level is to help them see who they are beyond just, I'm a football player or a ski racer or a tennis player or a golfer or whatever. Because so often they are. And you hear in the media and you see, you know, some of these athletes who are sort of like just jerks. And they certainly exist. But my experience with the vast, vast majority of high-level athletes is they're really good people. They're nice people. You know, they want to connect with you because so much of the world is not connected to them. And so really exploring what those strengths are, what their passions are, how they can take their experiences as athletes and apply them to some other area. And, you know, there's one former NBA player, I think it's John Amici. He became a psychotherapist of some sort, and he teaches skills to kids. And then you see it in the newscasters, sportscasters, and you see in business and so on. Eric Heiden has become an accomplished orthopedic surgeon. So it's a matter of helping athletes find what that next thing is that's going to consume them in a very positive way. so they can continue to live a healthy or maybe even start to have a very healthy life after. Because, you know, you retire at 36, that's relatively old for starting a career. But my gosh, that still leaves you 40 years ahead of you to explore some new avenue of your life. So it can be really scary, but it also can be wonderful and then a great new chapter in their lives.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and that's that kind of whole area of exploration that hopefully you'll come back and we can explore that further.
I'd love to.
Dr. Jim Taylor, thank you very much for joining us.
Great fun, Glenn. Thanks for having me.
That's all for now. If you'd like more information, check out the website sportscoachradio.com and the Twitter feed @sportscoachtalk. Thanks for listening.